Welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast.
Hello, Lawyers, Guns, and Money listeners. Today I have with me Professor Greg Weeks of University of North Carolina at Charlotte, dual appointment in Latin American Studies and in Political Science. For those of you who have really long memories of LGM and its antecedents, you'll remember Greg from being on Blogging Heads many, many moons ago talking about Cuba policy. How are you doing today, Greg?
I'm doing very well. How are you?
I am doing well. We are recording today on the day after the inauguration. And so I think like a lot of the readers of the blog, there is a certain degree of relief. And for me, there's a certain sort of ability that I can finally start thinking about my work rather than about, whether there's going to be a president in the next 3 days. So I'm doing just fine.
Yes. You can read the news without a sense of dread every morning.
Right, exactly. Today we are going to talk about one of the more unusual things of the Trump presidency and the Trump approach to foreign policy, but it's one that has been surprising to some people, that one of the people in the world who might be sad at seeing President Trump go away is the president of Mexico. I guess just to start us off with, could you take us through just a little bit of like how this apparently friendly relationship has developed between Trump and AMLO? Like what is the origin of this and what's going on with this?
So yeah, it just is weird. AMLO came to office on a platform that was pushing back against Trump. He famously wrote a book called Oye Trump, sort of Listen Up Trump. And it was about especially with migration, sort of the things that AMLO was demanding that Trump do. But it was like once they started getting to know each other, AMLO decided he liked them. And this is a matter of considerable debate and speculation with kind of two tracks, maybe, at least from my perspective. One is that they have a lot in common in terms of how they prefer to govern, and sort of the populist leaning kind of strategies, and suspicion of traditional media, that kind of thing, very heavy-handed, centralized. The other thing is that perhaps unlike other U.S. presidents, and perhaps also unlike Biden, is that Trump doesn't care about democracy very much. So, he wasn't going to push back on Mexico for corruption. He wasn't going to push back on anything except things like migration, maybe drugs that he felt were affecting the U.S. directly. But over time, I mean, AMLO, he would say the craziest things about just how great Trump was for Mexico. And it's just really, really strange for somebody who came to office supposedly leftist and supposedly anti-Trump.
You know, it's really interesting because, the things that I've read have, emphasized the sovereignty point, have sort of, like you say, the non-interference bit. It's interesting because it seems to put AMLO in a handful of leaders who are normally associated with right populism, very distinctly with right populism. And I'm thinking here of, obviously, Bolsonaro, of Erdogan, of Viktor Orban in Hungary. I'm not sure Boris Johnson is exactly the same, the same critter, but Putin and so forth. And so it's very interesting that sort of AMLO finds himself in perhaps the only real left winger in this group that is associated with sort of a revival of right wing populism globally.
Yeah, though the thing with AMLO is that he's very hard to pin down ideologically. So he seemed like more of a traditional leftist, but the way that he's governed has been a little bit more kind of traditional priista. So the party that was in power for Mexico for most of the 20th century. So it's hard to say that he's exactly leftist because, one example, one thing that is going to cause some tension with Biden is that he's very pro-fossil fuel. He sees the state-owned oil company as the PRI did, as this driving force of the Mexican economy and as a way to garner support. And that's very much not what you would think of as a leftist stance. He's been slower on labor reforms that the U.S. has been pushing for, also not real leftist. So he's not he's certainly not Bolsonaro. He's not right wing, but you know, he's not clearly leftist either.
Mm-hmm. So how is this playing out in the domestic politics of Mexico, right? Does he take a lot of fire from either or both wings in terms of his attitude towards Trump? I mean, I can't imagine Trump is particularly popular with Mexicans in general, you know, as apart from AMLO specifically.
Yeah, so that's also tricky. So when AMLO took office and then it was clear that Trump was going to become president, and even before he was sworn in, I mean, I, like a lot of other people, you know, figured that, you know, that AMLO was going to push back, and then we didn't push back, that it would be unpopular in Mexico. And that's not been the case. So that his approval ratings, while dipping, have been really good. And from people I've talked to, the idea is that they feel he shielded Mexico from maybe worse things that Trump might have done. And therefore, they're like, okay, fine, you go say what you want. But if you're protecting us from what's very clearly a potential threat and just a lot of uncertainty, then, you know, then we're fine with it. So he has not seemingly taken a hit domestically, even though if you look traditionally at Mexican politics, you would assume he would, because the, you know, sovereignty in Mexico is everything vis-a-vis the United States. So the whole dynamic is just really unusual.
Right, right. And it's, I mean, it's interesting because, I mean, this is a degree of sort of, you know, sort of call out hostility towards Mexico, the Mexican state that we haven't seen in a long time, and of a really racially tinged hostility from Trump and Trump's followers towards Mexico that, you know, it's basically unheard of for, you know, the last half century.
Just openly racist.
Right.
Openly racist. And I guess a majority of Mexican people feel that under such adverse conditions, AMLO has guided them through, and you know that, you know, he has not been hurt politically, or at least not so far. You know, he still is, has years left in his term, but he's doing okay.
Trump was in the campaign and really during his term, much more emphatic about sort of mobilizing the threat of Latin American communism to really talk, you know, it turned out to be motivating on the international and on the domestic, right? So, you know, he was able to really move serious numbers in South Florida based on Venezuelan and Cuban communism in ways that I would have been completely surprised by, right? That you just wouldn't expect socialism to have that effect. I mean, how has that played? I mean, because I know AMLO, or at least it was my understanding that AMLO at least sort of had friendly relations with Cuba and with Venezuela, but has that aspect been particularly difficult for Mexico in any way?
No, and that's a good question, because AMLO always waves the non-intervention flag when it comes to especially Venezuela. I mean, he is not on board was not on board with Trump's saber rattling. I think the big difference with Mexico is that, you know, it's not a big Mexican-American voters aren't swaying Florida. So that stance was aimed at Florida. It was aimed at Venezuelan Americans and Cuban Americans, and they bought it. So that it, I think, had this very, very narrowly targeted audience for what you hear of as Magazuelans, that as Venezuelans who came to Florida and ironically enough, see in Trump, although Trump has many similarities to Hugo Chavez, see in Trump somebody who can destroy socialism. And outside of that narrow context, doesn't really matter. I've never heard Trump talk about socialism as a problem or support for socialism as a problem for AMLO, because that's just not a Florida thing.
Right. Well, what about, I mean, people talked about how, and you know, there's been a lot of discussion. We are ranging a little bit here from where we were going to talk, but you know, we've talked a lot about how there's not really a Latino vote in the United States. There are many, right? But, you know, it did seem that Trump made substantial inroads into Mexican-American communities in the Rio Grande Valley. Or should we think of those as Central American communities now, or are they sort of, is there still Mexican-American areas? But at least he did see substantial gains there.
Yeah, I think a lot of that can be explained by social conservatism. So if you're very concerned about abortion, for example, things like that, then you're still attracted to the Republican Party. And maybe you find a lot of the other issues that Trump deals with as distasteful. But the same is true even of other people in the United States. If you're fairly narrowly focused on social conservatism, then somebody like Biden and certainly somebody like Hillary Clinton is going to be somebody that you just can't vote for. I don't know if it's how much of it's inroads, but he didn't lose it. Trump didn't lose those voters in a way that a lot of people assumed that he would. That held pretty steady.
Right. What do you make of AMLO's decision to offer amnesty to Julian Assange? You know, there was a lot of discussion on the internet, a lot of discussion everywhere else that Trump was just going to go ahead and pardon Assange and possibly also pardon Edward Snowden. And apparently there were like warnings coming out of the Senate not to do that. But what's the upside for AMLO to step up and give amnesty to this guy who has nothing to do with Mexican foreign policy?
That's a tough one. I don't know that he has a whole lot of upside unless he is simply trying to say to the Latin American left, hey, I'm one of you. That was when Rafael Correa, stayed very connected with Assange to the disgust of then the next Ecuadorian president who was like, I don't want anything to do with this. It could just be that he wants to prove that he's one of them. Though, I mean, that's the only thing I can really think of, though I don't know how much upside that is, because it's not as if he needs to prove himself to Venezuela. Venezuela's collapsed. Mm. So there's sort of a regional upside. Domestically, I can't think of any. I can't think of any. I have a feeling that Assange is going to be a pain in the butt because he...
That's who he is.
Yeah, and so that one was weird. It was really out of left field. Mm-hmm. No pun intended. But I don't know that he really gains very much from it. And maybe it's something that he figures, okay, I can do this symbolically, but it won't actually happen.
Right.
That's low risk. He's never actually going to end up in Mexico. So that's no big deal. And then actually the funniest thing was that people immediately were making comparisons to Trotsky.
No, that occurred to me. It occurred to me exactly then. Right?
I was like, Assange might not want to go to Mexico, frankly.
Right. Exactly. So can you, as I was just doing a little bit of research ahead of you and I speaking, I ran into a lot of discussion. Maybe you can explain a little bit about what's going on with respect to this General Cienfuegos, right. Who is, I guess, as I understand it, supposed to be a pretty substantial sore point between the United States and Mexico right now, because he was either indicted in the U.S. or he was supposed to be indicted, but then he was sent to Mexico, and now he's been released in all charges. And now there's this question about whether people properly translated some of the indictable material that was to be used against him. I mean, just sort of in general terms, what is going on with this guy, and why is he important to the relationship?
Yeah, so he was Mexico's defense minister under the previous Mexican government. So very high level, and the U.S. accused him of very serious drug trafficking through a cartel, so direct connections to a Mexican cartel. So the U.S. put a high priority on nabbing him, and they got him when he came to the U.S. I think they got him, if I remember correctly, it was in L.A. It might have been, I think, even at the airport. And but they didn't tell Mexico. As I think the U.S. often doesn't, because they're concerned about leaks. And this ties into something that also distinguishes AMLO from sort of traditional leftists, and that is that he has courted the Mexican military. He's become very close to the military. He's given the military all kinds of tasks, big national tasks. And the military was pushing very, very hard to bring Cienfuegos home. And so AMLO was responding to that in part. He's also responding to what he sees as a as an affront to Mexican sovereignty, is that you just grab this person and, you know, there really should be more cooperation on this, or at least that this should be something for the Mexican courts, not U.S. courts. And from my understanding, it was Bill Barr who was the one who pushed to go ahead and agreed to send him back. But the idea was that from the U.S. side is that, well, then he's going to have to stand trial in Mexico. Now, nobody really figured that there'd be a serious trial in Mexico, because that's kind of not how it works, especially with very high level people. But the article, the recent article, shows that the U.S. might have botched it. I haven't had time to look through it all, but, you know, AMLO released the documents, 700 something pages of these documents. And now apparently, as people are looking through them, the U.S. interpreters didn't know Mexican slang. So the article there was about they're not knowing what testicles were, basically, you know, things like this sort of slang that could have twisted their entire understanding of what was going on with all of these text messages. So if that's true, then that's big. And so it's the Drug Enforcement Agency, which AMLO has restricted now in Mexico, stripping away diplomatic immunity, forcing them to share intelligence if they have it. So for AMLO, it was a big package. It was drug policy, it was the military, it was sovereignty, and now, for better or for worse, he's a free man.
Now, the first question I had about this, is it typical for a uniformed officer to be a Minister of Defense in Mexico? Is this normal procedure?
Right offhand, I don't remember. I would think not. I'd have to check. I mean, Mexico traditionally has, at least since the revolution, does not have a high-profile presence of the military. The military is well taken care of. It was a supporter of whatever government was in power, because it was given a healthy budget, and you know, the government didn't interfere with it, but it was much less brought into politics directly. And so this is one thing observers of Mexican politics have noted, that it's much more high profile now. So I have to look back. It wouldn't surprise me if somebody was, but it's noteworthy that this person was defense minister, and also somebody that the U.S. was looking at.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I wrote a short piece a while ago on how much of an outlier Mexico is internationally with respect to its defense budget, which is something like 0.7% of GDP, which is just is unheard of. It's staggeringly low by international standards, which is, you know, remains very interesting to me. I mean, you can have explanations for it, but
I would assume a lot of it, they don't have high price tag. Right. Purchases, stuff like that, because I think in general the Mexican military feels that it's well treated, but that doesn't automatically mean that they're getting fancy planes and things like that. But
right. I think it's a complete lack of modern combat aircraft and a complete lack of modern combat vessels for the Navy. But again, you know, it is a substantial outlier, not just regionally but globally, in terms of a wealthy country having a small military. I guess to shift over a little bit and to just sort of look more exactly, how much longer does AMLO have on his term? Because it's 1 6-year term, if I recollect correctly.
Yeah, right? He took office in, 2018? So roughly halfway through.
Right. So what is your take on, you know, in the United States, we have an almost very unique situation where we are having a leadership transition as we are bottoming out in terms of the pandemic, right? So there can be for us sort of this crisp conceptual transition between, which I'm sure that Biden is counting on enjoying, this crisp you know, conceptual transition between being at the bottom of the pandemic and this new thing looking forward. Now, Mexico's pandemic response has also been pretty harshly criticized, if I'm to understand correctly.
Yep.
So what does the rest of AMLO's term look like, right? I mean, is he going to be, he hasn't taken a substantial hit so far, as I understand it. You know, but what does the rest of his term look like?
I mean, I'm not an epidemiologist, but I would think that a lot of that would depend on how vaccinated he can get the country. He was quite bad. He was a person who was high profile, hugging people and things like that early on. But you know, if the Mexican economy continues to struggle as other economies, more developed countries pick up, I mean, at some point that has to start eroding his approval. But you know, Mexico faces the same problem as other poor countries. I mean, Mexico's not poor by, say, global standards, but it's certainly far behind the U.S. is that, you know, the vaccines are expensive. And distribution is really difficult. So I think a lot of that's going to have to, it'll depend on, you know, on how effective the state is at getting people vaccinated and thereby getting the economy going, because there's still a lot of time in this term. And if people are suffering year after year after year, well, then eventually that's going to have to hit him. Not too yet, but it can.
Do you know, just offhand, because I know that Brazil has had some problems with took the Chinese vaccine, which is currently having some, you know, tremendous effectiveness issues, at least from the Brazilian data. Do you know offhand whether Mexico is going Chinese or Moderna or Pfizer or anything else, or are they just sort of letting anyone?
Offhand, I'm not sure. I don't even know if they might have gone Russian, but offhand, I don't know. But my general sense is that, you know, like Pfizer is one of the more expensive ones. So I would figure that that the Chinese vaccine would be attractive. But I don't know offhand, you know, kind of what the percentages are in terms of what Mexico is trying to get.
I mean, I just to wrap up, you know, what do you think are going to be the major sticking points? You know, you talked a little bit about, you know, here are the major things that Trump cared about. I feel like Biden is going to care about the same things, just in different directions. You know, but the immigration thing is going to be because he wants to work on it on day one, and that's going to involve Mexico right away. But sort of for the rest of the AMLO and for the first half of the Biden administration, what do you think are going to be the big pressure points in U.S.-Mexican relations?
I think corruption could be one. So, you know, Biden paid quite a bit of attention to Latin America while he was vice president, and he was the one that helped push for the UN organization to start prosecuting corruption in Guatemala. And so he cares about that. And that's one thing that Mexico has suffered from. AMLO, like many presidents, has claimed to be going after it and really hasn't. So I could see that being one thing. And that's something that Trump didn't care about, obviously, at all. And I think climate, AMLO's been pretty vocal that, you know, he's really not into renewable energy. And so I have a feeling that those things are going to become a problem. I mean, I don't know. They're not the most important, because immigration narcotics are, you know, more important, and certainly trade. But even trade has problems because, for example, just this morning, apparently, in his AMLO has these funky morning press conferences. And one a few days ago, he was showing a cartoon. So he shows stuff. But today he seemed to be suggesting that energy was outside the auspices of the new agreement, USMCA, that replaced NAFTA. And everyone's like, no, I don't think that's, no. You know, sovereignty, there's an, you know, you sign this agreement and you give up some sovereignty. So things like energy, things like labor, because he's been criticized for not improving wages, hours, things like that. These are all tied into the trade agreement. And so I could see that as a bundle becoming a problem. And those are things that Trump ignored And AMLO was happy that he ignored it, and Biden's not going to ignore it. So, you know, it's about, well, how much does Biden push on it? And AMLO hasn't really made friends with him yet. So, you know, maybe there will be some pushing.
Right. Now, the corruption part was also, I mean, it's interesting that, you know, Biden took it seriously during while he was vice president. It was also one of the big talking points that made it through or that Bernie Sanders really concentrated his foreign policy conversation on. And I know that that sort of filtered into the Biden machine as well. So it's very interesting to me whether you'll see significant movement on corruption in Mexico.
Yeah. And Biden has taken on some of those issues that perhaps fell by the wayside at times, and that the many in the Democratic Party value a lot. So I could see perhaps Biden pushing more than, say, Obama would have.
Greg, well, I think I've reached the end of my questions, but this has been brief and it's been good. So is there anything else you want to say, or we call it a day?
No. All I can say is that AMLO has been unpredictable so far. So any predictions that I've made or you think I've made could well be wrong. That's about it.
Yeah, no, that's always something I reserve for myself as well. Any predictions you think that I have made or could be wrong. Anyway.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Greg. And thank you to our LGM listeners for joining us as well. And stay tuned and come back in the future.
All right. Thanks.
Thank you again for listening to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. We would like to thank Elizabeth Nelson of The Paranoid Style for supplying the music necessary to make this podcast possible. You can find this track and the rest of The Paranoid Style's catalog anywhere you can find quality music. If you would like to support the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast or any other aspect of the Lawyers, Guns, and Money project, please visit us at www.patreon.com/lawyersgunsandmoney or donate through the PayPal link on the main website. Thank you again.